All right. Welcome back to the Tank Me Later podcast. This is episode 64. And today the guys from Ingle Fantasy Basketball are going to be joining me to talk about the 2024 NBA draft and talk about a little fantasy hoops to go along with that. So with that being said, let's go ahead and get into it. Really quickly before I bring them in, I just want to remind you guys that support for this Fantasy Basketball International podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Shaving your jewels doesn't have to be risky business anymore thanks to the Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra. This trimmer is all about keeping things smooth and safe so you can trim with confidence. Treat your wrinkle berries and join the 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped by going to manscaped.com to get 20% off plus free shipping with the code FBI20. With Manscaped, it is easy grooming, no surprises. We know every dude gets the heebie-jeebies when it's time for a close shave down under, especially when using the wrong tools. That's precisely why Manscaped is my go-to for those delicate spots. Trust me, this trimmer will be your crown jewel's new best buddy. Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code FBI20 at manscaped.com. That is 20% off plus free shipping with the code FBI20 at manscaped.com. Show your balls some love and feel free. As a dove, as I said, I am Noah Rubin. This is the Tank Me Later podcast, episode 64, and we're talking about the draft. So I'm going to go ahead and bring in the guys from Ingle Fantasy Basketball. We have Mitchell, we have Braxton, and we have Andrew. Gentlemen, how has the draft process been for you guys? I'll start with you, Mitchell. How's it been going with the so-called week 2024 draft class?
It's funny you say that because even though you say it's weak, this is one of my favorite draft classes to really evaluate. You know, we're going to be talking about one of my fan favorites later on in this podcast, Reed Shepard. And I think he has potentially top 20 upside if everything hits. So, you know, even though this is self-proclaimed a weak draft class, there are many gems to be found.
Definitely. It's been a very fun class for me as well. Braxton, you kind of share that sentiment of this being a much better class, at least for us, maybe, than what everybody else is kind of saying.
Yeah, I think the narrative has really gotten just kind of spiraled out of control. You know, I've been reading some discussion like on the Caruso Giddey trade that just happened a couple days ago. And like there was a rumored like pick 13 on the table for Caruso. And then people being like, oh yeah, pick 13 is just like equivalent to like a second in other drafts. So like maybe misunderstanding what a bad draft actually means. It's just a lot more level, I guess, than normal years. So, yeah, just definitely some hidden gems, I think, we found later in the draft.
Yeah, it's exciting times for us with it being tomorrow. Andrew, how do you kind of feel about it?
Man, I'm just glad that we had this podcast scheduled for today because I'm chomping at the bit to see the draft tomorrow. So this is helping to satisfy that by getting on and talking about some rookies today. And just going into the narrative of the week draft class – I mean, the real reason why it's like that is just because there's not a potential all-star at the top, or like franchise-altering player is more so what I should say, at the top of this draft class. But that doesn't mean there's much of a difference between the later picks of this draft and the later picks of other years' drafts too. So we're going to dive into one of those guys today, and it's just been really fun to be able to try to pick out some guys that you think stand above the rest and, you know, find that there actually is some good to this 2022 draft class. There's a lot of useful guys, especially for fantasy nine category.
Yeah, there's no true guaranteed safe star like a Wemby, but there's definitely a lot of depth. I'm excited to see kind of where everybody lands. And I think arguably the most fun part about this class and ranking players and making a big board is that you could have somebody in your top 10 that somebody else has at 50 or 60. And everybody's just kind of like, okay, well, I don't know really where everybody's going to end up because it's such a wide range of outcomes. I think it makes it fun, exciting, interesting, whatever you want to call it. But we'll go ahead and get into some of these prospects. I have some slides here just showing the three guys that we're going to talk about. And then maybe we'll get into some others if we have some time. But we'll start with Reed Shepard, who averaged 12.5 points, 4.1 rebounds, 4.5 assists, 2.5 steals, 2.3 threes, shot a ridiculous 53.6% from the floor, even more ridiculous 52.1% from three, 83.1% from the free throw line, played 28.9 minutes in more of a six-man role for Kentucky. And you guys have him as your number two player in your latest dynasty rankings. Mitchell, I know this is your guy. How are you kind of feeling about Reed Sheppard? What makes you like him so much?
Man, Reed Sheppard does a little bit of everything. And I just want to add a little bit of context about Reed Sheppard's recruitment. So Reed Sheppard, he's the son of Jeff Sheppard, who played at Kentucky. He won two national titles there. And also his mom played at Kentucky for their women's basketball team as well. So a lot of times he was kind of seen as that legacy recruit. He was only the 23rd ranked player out of the ESPN's top 100 rankings. And let me remind the audience that this is excluding all the international prospects as well. So think Alex Sarr, Zachary Risache. He wasn't, you know, really self-proclaimed as one of the surefire one and dones, you know, let alone a potential top three pick in this NBA draft. So I do want to point out he was the sixth man for Kentucky, playing behind DJ Wagner, who was the number two point guard of the class behind Isaiah Collier. He's also played behind a super senior, Antonio Reeves, who is all SEC. So, you know, there is a lot of ambiguity in his role coming into the year, but he really, really shined despite all of it and made himself a potential top three pick. I know you mentioned his statistical profile. There's really no weaknesses whatsoever. And I mentioned his fantasy outlook. At the peak, I could see this profile as top 20, and then even on his floor to like top 60 if, you know, everything goes wrong, even as like a low-end starter. His stat set is just that clean.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. The stats definitely jumped off the page for me when I was going through and looking at, through them. Andrew, are you kind of in agreement here as far as how you feel about Reed Sheppard? He's just kind of unreal statistically.
Yeah, he is unreal statistically, absolutely. I mean, it was on lower volume, which is easier to have better, better shooting splits at. So, I mean, obviously we're not expecting his role in the NBA to be, you know, a massive amount of usage. His role will probably be pretty similar to what it was in Kentucky. So I'm very curious to see his landing spot being. But I mean, Reed Sheppard is somebody who can really fit on any team. Like, for example, the Houston Rockets, I think at the beginning of this draft process, there was a lot of chatter that they're likely going to trade out of that spot. Like, for example, if Memphis wants to move up to three to take Klingon. But lately, I think we're seeing Houston come around to just the idea of just screw it. Let's just take Reed Sheppard if he's there. So even if he's in Houston, which is a team that could potentially be pushing for a playoff spot next season, or if he's in San Antonio, I really don't hate any fit that Reed Sheppard has. I'm just curious to see if this one, you know, if this season was a statistical outlier or not. But he does have a lot of good indicators, especially his athletic ability. I can't recall if Mitch mentioned or not, like his vertical ability. He had some good measurements at the combine that were very impressive. So some things, especially that verticality, makes up for his small stature, I would say, too. So I do believe in Reed for sure.
Yeah, that was going to be one thing I pointed out was the 42-inch vertical. Like I had seen the three-point shooting and the steal rate a long time ago, and then he comes out to the combine. I was like, I didn't even realize that he had that type of vertical. Braxton, are you kind of on the same page? Like this kind of seems like one of the most safe prospects in this class that also still has a ton of upside.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying. To me, profiles kind of just like a mix between Desmond Bane and Mike Conley. Where his ceiling isn't really like a number one guy on a team, but more so like that number two, like how Desmond Bane can be. Like you said, he's very safe. And, you know, I think obviously he's not going to go to a winning team, but I think he's one of the guys earlier on in this draft that could help a winning team right now. So,
yeah, definitely feels, even though he is kind of a younger prospect, a guy that is pretty ready to play in the NBA. His skill set should translate pretty smoothly. I think the question now is, do NBA teams see him as a shooting guard or do they see him as a guy that could potentially be a point guard? I think that will kind of impact where he's drafted and how he profiles out both as an NBA player as well as in fantasy basketball. So it'll be interesting to see where he lands in the draft. I think that's kind of the case for pretty much everybody in this class is landing spot's going to be pretty important.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Before we
no, please go ahead. On,
I'd like to talk about some of these potential landing spots for Reed Sheppard.
Please.
So if we are kind of aligned with the Vegas odds, Reed Sheppard is pretty much a heavy favorite to go to the Houston Rockets. And this is actually a really great fit in the long term. You know, we kind of see this, you know, for immediate return of investment, like, oh, Fred VanVleet is there. Is he going to get a starting role off the bat? Probably not. But looking deeper into Fred VanVleet's contract, after next year, he does have a team option. So if Reed Sheppard is ready to steer the ship as the main facilitator and lead guard, he can have it. You know, it's just a matter of time. This is his really a trial period for him to see if he can handle the keys to the offense next to Şengün as well. But the number one fit, in my opinion, fantasy-wise and in real life, is to the San Antonio Spurs, where he can really be the lead guard right off the bat. He could be the initiator. He could show us some of his self-creation skills that we didn't really get to see while he wasn't featured in the Kentucky offense, and just overall more opportunities for him to flourish. And there's no real competition in the long run, but we'll see. Everything is kind of very ambiguous right now at the moment. I know Vegas odds could say one thing, but on the day of the draft, a lot of tables can turn, and it could just honestly be a complete, you know, circus at the end of the day.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Was there something else that we had on Reed Sheppard? I think it sounded like somebody was starting to talk at the same time. Maybe not. Okay, cool. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I think both those fits are great, and I would be pretty shocked if he was available at four, if he made it past the Spurs. Feels like a pretty safe guy to go to one of those two spots, barring a bunch of trades. But still, I don't really think that happens, and he ends up sliding down the board. Which the Spurs would be, I think, better for year one production, but Houston wouldn't be a bad spot long-term either. We will now move on to AJ Mitchell. So when you guys sent me these prospects, I was like, okay, cool. A guy I really like, Reed Sheppard, a guy I'm not a huge fan of, which we'll talk about next. And then a guy that I didn't have a super strong opinion on. So kind of made me go a little bit deeper on AJ Mitchell. I watched his interview with Sam Vecenie earlier today as well. Which was pretty interesting to get a little bit more insight on him. But he averaged 20 points, 4 rebounds, 4 assists, 1.2 steals, 1.1 threes this past season, while shooting 50.4% from the floor, 39.3% from three, and 85.8% from the free throw line. You guys have him at number 28 on your latest board, which I think pretty much consensus that from what I've seen is somewhere from late first to anywhere in the second. So it's pretty wide range. Andrew, this, to my understanding, this is your guy. So
oh, yeah.
I'd love to hear all about him.
All right. So that's a big reason why I wanted to include a player like this one, is because majority of people are not going to have any idea who he is until his name is called in the NBA draft. So it's good to try to get an idea of these guys early on, especially if we're talking for dynasty basketball. So you can try to position yourself in the draft early for where you think somebody right here is going to land. So this next guy, or AJ Mitchell, is a deeper cut for you deep league dynasty players out there. And we've got to go through a lot of info on him because, for starters, a lot of people don't know about him. But also, too, it's trying to see if we can really unearth a gem at the end of the first round. So for whatever reason, pick 20 all the way through round two and down to undrafted free agents appears to be my comfort zone when evaluating talent, like collaborating with Mitchell and Braxton on our big board and everything. So this is one of my favorites within that range that I wanted to share. Every draft seems to have like 1 to 3 guys late first round, early second round, coming from a school not known for making basketball prospects, and just a school no one has heard of in general is the other option too. So recent examples is like Ben Sheppard and Jalen Pickett last year, David Roddy and Patrick Baldwin Jr. the year prior, Santi Aldama and Jason Preston in 2021. So that brings us to AJ Mitchell. He actually just turned 22 years old today, so happy birthday to him. He is an offense-first point guard from UC Santa Barbara, born and raised in Belgium because his father played professionally there. He won pretty much every award you can think of in the Big West, which is traditionally a power baseball conference, so not really known for basketball. He also helped Santa Barbara earn 2 trips to March Madness. What you were saying with his stats earlier, 20 points, 4 rebounds, 4 assists, he's actually only 1 of 4 players in the country to average that amount. We actually got the chance, Mitchell and I, to scout him in person back in March. We did a vlog on our impression of him, which you can find on our YouTube channel. Looking at his combine numbers, one thing I like to look at is hand size. So he has bigger hands than Reed Sheppard or Rob Dillingham, and similar hand size to Isaiah Collier or Nikola Topic. His standing reach was third among point guards, only behind Juan Nunez and Nikola Topic, and 10th among all guards. Wingspan was sixth among point guards and 17th among all guards. Combine measurements were very similar to Andrew Nembhard, whose name is going to come up a lot here. And as Noah talked about with those shooting splits, flirting, as you can see, with the 50-40-90 club. He had a true shooting of 61% last year. We actually saw him take a massive jump in three-point shooting, but I will add some context here. He oddly shot below 30% from three in the 2022-2023 season, which is why there's such a massive spike coming into this year. He did shoot above 30% in his freshman season, but what we really love to see is him approaching 40% this most recent season, even if it's on low volume. What showed vast improvement in each season was his scoring and ability to get to the free throw line more often, where he shot 85% on six attempts per game. So his field goal percentage never dipped below 50%, despite taking a 4 to 5 point per game scoring jump each season. He scored 25 or more points in a third of his games last season. He had five games with 30 points or more. Some of the main indicators we look at when trying to predict NBA success are steal or block rates, which AJ admittedly isn't stellar at. He's not somebody like the player we just talked about, Reed Sheppard, and that's likely why he's more of a late first round to early second round pick. But the ability to get to the free throw line is an important indicator to look at, which AJ is very good at, top 80 in the country. You filter it down to guys that are actually going to be in this draft. He's only behind Edie, Daron Holmes, Dalton Knecht, and Terrence Shannon in total free throw attempts for last season. He's showing he's physically dominant and crafty enough to get past his primary defender and draw fouls at a high rate. And this is what we want to see to indicate he can hang with NBA level competition. He's a major threat to split lanes and finish with his craftiness and excellent body control. And if you send him to the line, those are easy makes for him as well. Back to his defense really quickly. Although AJ isn't producing high stocks numbers and likely won't do that in the NBA, he's still a capable defender. We don't label him as a liability. One of his best features we like about him is his basketball IQ. So that helps to keep his defense afloat with good defensive awareness and instincts, which should allow him to stay on the floor. He does have great defensive intensity. We're just really missing the active hands that someone like a Reed Sheppard is much better at. But we also know AJ was the focal point of his team and had far less freedom to attempt steals and potentially rack up fouls in doing so, unlike Sheppard, who had a lower usage role. Some other cons to AJ: he does not have an amazing assist to turnover ratio. He does lack elite athleticism. He did not place among the top five among guards in any of agility, speed, or vertical measurements at the combine. But his numbers do look a little bit better when you compare them to only point guards. He's definitely more of a change of pace type of player to use that to create separation. He's worked out with 17 teams. So he's worked out twice with Minnesota, who has picks 27 and 37. He's worked out with Denver, who has pick 28, Utah, who has picks 29 and 32. The Pacers, he worked out with the Knicks. They both own late first round picks. So it's looking like our projection of where he might go back when we did our vlog on him in March is going to be pretty spot on. His body type potential stat set is very reminiscent of Andrew Nembhard. Nembhard's more of an assist heavy true point guard, whereas AJ is more talented in the scoring department. Like a 90th percentile in isolation scoring efficiency, but he did have 90 percentile or better in pick and roll frequency and efficiency. A comparison, which is probably at the ceiling for AJ's potential, is Austin Reeves, especially if AJ's scoring translates well. Reeves' scoring and three free throw rate were very similar in his final year of college to AJ's past year, and those were Reeves' main indicators for success because he was also not that great at steals or blocks. So we view AJ as someone like a Nembhard or Reeves who can either start alongside the rest of the stars and have the IQ to make an impact without that much usage, or he can run the show when a star sits and is injured, similar to what Nembhard did when Haliburton was injured. Another early comparison we came up with back in our March vlog was Monte Morris, which is probably the floor. So again, focusing on clean percentages, scoring, and assists, with the cons being so-so at steals and low three-point volume. So there's a lot more potential for him to grow. Even at his age, he's taken big steps each year in college, and he definitely has an NBA body. He's coming out of this draft around the same age that Andrew Nembhard was when he was drafted, 2 years younger than Austin Reaves was when he was signed. He's younger than Tyler Kolek, Tristan Da Silva, and Dalton Kincaid. So we think from a dynasty and fantasy perspective, he has a very safe floor because there's no real weakness in his stat set. He's not somebody, other prospects at this range who are high ceiling gambles with low floors like a Ryan Dunn or a Bobby Klintman. He's not really like that. He's at worst, he won't hurt you anywhere, but still has upside to be a positive nine cat contributor. So of course, Mitch and I especially love AJ because we attended a Big West school together, and it's so rare to see any NBA prospect come from there. Last one was Gabe Vincent, who wasn't even drafted. So we've definitely been hyping AJ as much as we can and really hope to see him land in the first round. Of the teams that he worked out with, we like Minnesota the most fit-wise. Clearest path to minutes, good fit for what Minnesota wants. Can fill the void when Mike Conley is off the floor and would essentially just be replacing Monte Morris, who they acquired at the deadline. I mean, he has the length that Minnesota does covet for their system. So I think especially someone like AJ with his rim attacking style will heavily benefit from NBA spacing, similar to what I think might happen for Isaiah Collier if he lands in a good spot for him with good spacing. And this is something we saw evidence of with AJ's performance at the combine with better teammates than what he has at Santa Barbara. So I very much look forward to seeing how his career goes. Do you guys have any thoughts on AJ Mitchell?
Andrew, that was an incredibly in-depth breakdown.
I wanted to go super in-depth because I guarantee a lot of people have no idea who he is. So that's the only reason why.
No, it was great. I think we need to call up AJ Mitchell's agent and just get you on the PR team. That's what I think we need to do as soon as this is over. Braxton, I know Andrew covered a lot. Is there anything else that you have to add about AJ Mitchell or just things you really want to reiterate?
Yeah, I mean, I really think Andrew nailed it. Something I do want to note, so later in the draft, especially in fantasy drafts, people tend to overlook some guys that are quote unquote older with AJ at 22. This does not feel like somebody you should, discount because of his age. If he goes to somewhere, in addition to Minnesota, like Andrew mentioned, if he lands somewhere like Phoenix at 22 or Milwaukee at 23, where he can kind of step in and play immediately, I think there's definitely fantasy value there, from day one. Similar, Andrew mentioned Andrew Nembhard. I think that's a great comparison in terms of fantasy skill set and output in the first year or two. So definitely somebody I would have my eye on.
Yeah, and Mitchell, Andrew mentioned that you guys were able to scout AJ Mitchell in person. Is there anything else that you took away from that in-person scouting trip?
Yeah, he was a lot more built than what I expected, coming into the game. He has broad shoulders. I know Andrew mentioned he has a big hand size, and he has an NBA level body to either play the lead guard at 6'4" or even as a combo guard if he improves his shooting. One thing I do want to mention and reiterate what Braxton said is some of these older prospects have a really high return of value, especially at the early second round. So Andrew Nembhard, someone who I drafted in previous leagues, Herb Jones, someone who can really just be a plug and play guy, and Quentin Grimes, once upon a time, was an asset in New York for dynasty owners as well. So actually, sorry, Quentin Grimes didn't go in the second round in real life, but a lot of times he was drafted in these rookie dynasty drafts. So don't really kind of neglect these older prospects because, you never know in a year or two, maybe they become top 150 assets that you can flip later on for a higher upside prospect in the teens and in a future year. So yeah, AJ Mitchell is a great gamble you can make.
Yeah, no, I really like that point about still looking at older prospects, even though it's a lot more fun to just draft 18, 19 year olds that have all the upside in the world. But like you mentioned, it could be a guy that either starts off really well just because he is 22 or 23 that you can flip and get picks, or just ends up being a really good basketball player, because that happens. A good example of that last year was Jaime Jaquez, who was able to come in from year one and be a rotation player. Obviously, he was a first rounder, so he wasn't entirely overlooked, but he wasn't seen as an appealing fantasy player until he started playing and getting minutes because he was a good basketball player. Andrew, the Minnesota Timberwolves fit that you kind of mentioned, as well as some other teams, but I think when you mentioned that he worked out for them twice, I was like, okay, I can really see that thing working where, when Mike Conley is ready to retire, potentially like a sort of passing the torch. I don't know exactly if AJ Mitchell will fill that role or be able to develop to the point where he is a starting point guard. and a really effective one at that. But I think that if there was a good landing spot for him to potentially get there, it's in Minnesota with another lefty point guard who is an incredibly efficient point guard, which is one thing you mentioned that wasn't a great aspect of Mitchell's game, was his efficiency. Some of the turnovers were a bit of an issue. So can you add, and Andrew, any more about that potential fit in Minnesota?
So with something like Minnesota, you really love these plug and play options, especially if we're talking dynasty basketball. If you are either a team who did well last year, you kept your pick and you're about to pick somewhere in the 20s, or you've just acquired something in the 20s, and you're really not trying to get some 19-year-old that you need to wait 2 years for in the G League. You want somebody who's going to hit the ground running and produce now. This is going to be your guy if you want somebody like that. There are, of course, people who are fine taking projects at this point in the draft. But, you know, there are people out there, dynasty managers, who want immediate production from their rookies, especially if we're talking salary leagues. If he's drafted in the late 20s, he's making, you know, like $3-ish million, but putting up some okay numbers and producing at the end of your bench, and it's going to have cost control. That's a great asset to have. So that's what we want. I mean, I really don't view AJ as a, okay, go to the G League to develop more. I view him, and especially the teams looking at him, clearly as a, you're going to help us as soon as you get here.
And I just want to add real quick, Andrew, I think you're talking a little bit more from a deeper league perspective.
I
don't want to discount, 12 teamers in the second rounds of rookie drafts either. You know, that's definitely somebody who can correct, who, you know, you can get in the second round and provide value right away. So even in shallower leagues like that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think obviously the one comparison that comes up that would be his absolute ceiling is Jalen Brunson, just being an older lefty point guard that is very skilled offensively. So that would be an absolute home run if AJ Mitchell ended up being Jalen Brunson, but we'll temper our expectations a little bit. But still a guy to definitely consider in the middle of your 30 team draft or in the second or third round of a shallower league draft. But we will move on to Zach Edey, who you guys are a good bit higher on than I am, but he's obviously the best player in college basketball this past season, averaged 25.2 points, 12.2 rebounds, 2 assists, 2.2 blocks, shot 62.3% from the floor, spent half the season at the free throw line. You guys have him number 15 on your big board. Braxton, we'll start with you. Sell me on Zach Edey. Why is he going to be a good NBA player?
Yeah, you know, I don't think anybody's denying Edey's potential fantasy upside. You know, this is really all about his landing spot and if he's going to have a big enough role to be fantasy relevant. Earlier on in his college career, he was getting mocked as a second-round pick. But after the last two seasons of being Purdue's best player and then maybe the last season the best player in college basketball, you know, taking them to the NCAA championship, which they did lose, you know, he's increased his stock significantly into a potential top 10 pick in this year's draft. He's 7'4", 300 pounds. He's the biggest player on the court any given night. And, you know, the comp some people are giving him are Boban, which at first glance may not be the most ringing endorsement, but we do know how effective, how effective Boban has always been in his limited minutes. And just on the surface level, if Edey's able to put up the kind of stats that Boban does in his limited minutes, you know, just imagine what kind of fantasy asset he'll be with 20, 24 minutes a night, especially if he gets drafted to a bad team. So my personal projection is something a little closer to Ivica Zubac with better rebounding and finishing. So like you said, his senior year at Purdue, he averaged 25 and 12, as well as 2 blocks on 62% shooting. But the big question really is lateral quickness. This is something we saw Zubac work on a lot in the late years of his career. And then only after we saw him get swapped for Mike Muscala with the Clippers, we saw him take that next step and get legitimate playing time. The advantage Edey here has is that his offensive game is so much more fine-tuned coming into the league, as well as his ability to play heavy minutes. He's got that cardio for somebody that size. He averaged 32 minutes a night last season. So his ceiling, and don't laugh, I know you just said you weren't very high on him, but his ceiling to me is Yao Ming. He's got the ability to completely dominate at both ends on the floor on any given night. And he's got unbelievable touch for a big man, which includes the ability to knock down free throws at decent clips, shooting 70%. A middle outcome to me would be like an Al Jefferson, where his offense will keep him
his offense will keep him in a significant role on the right team. And he is also able to defend the rim. And then his lateral quickness, like I mentioned earlier, and his ability to defend in space will always be a struggle. So that kind of resorts into starting some nights, but mainly a bench big. And then his floor is likely a more playable or relevant Boban, where he's strictly a bench big who plays, you know, 16 to 18 minutes a night. But in those 18 minutes, he sees significant usage. Talk about landing spots real quick. You know, there are some rumors that he has a promise in the top 10. And either Memphis or Utah at 9 or 10 seem like potential decent landing spots to me, especially with Utah, with the reported concerns about Walker Kessler as a long-term solution. Memphis is also particularly interesting, where they could move Jaren Jackson down to the fourth if they wanted to try and have like a Twin Towers-like situation. It's kind of unclear what they would what would happen with Brandon Clark in that scenario. Is Edie and Clark are not going to play together. They don't fit at all. But that shouldn't prevent them from taking an impact player like Edie. And then this is also reaching a little bit high, but Charlotte at six is also kind of interesting to me. I don't think he gets picked at six, though. And then outside of the top 10, some of the landing spots I like are Chicago at 11 to kind of just fully step in where Drummond is leaving off and then hopefully takes over for Vucevic a couple years from now. Oklahoma City at 12 to get some of that size they desperately need. And, you know, there's nobody bigger, so it should, you know, fit the bill pretty well. And then, you know, there's some concern there with OKC about his playing time. If he struggles early, is they're now hunting for a title. But then if he takes a little bit of a fall outside the lottery, which I don't think is very likely, down at 18, I do like Orlando as well. I just don't think Wendell Carter Jr. Or Mo Wagner are all that good. And I think there's room for him to make an impact there on another team that's lacking size. But if he does fall out of the lottery, like I just mentioned, I do think it's likely a team trades up in that 15, 16, 17 range to make him, and just where it just makes a lot of sense for him to get to 18 anyway. In terms of fantasy implications, year one, on the right team, I think it's going to be a cakewalk to top 100 upside. You know, if he's playing 20 minutes, I think in nine category leagues, you know, the blocks, the efficiency, that kind of stuff can propel you so far. And if he gets 20 minutes a night, I don't think it's outside the realm of possibilities to slide inside the top 100 year one.
Yeah, that's great stuff. I think there's no question that he's an accomplished, talented basketball player. I think my main concern is something that you hit on. I mean, you hit on things that made me less concerned, such as him playing 32 minutes. And as you compare that to a guy like Donovan Clingan, who's only playing 22 minutes per night, you know, it does put it into perspective a little bit of, hey, this guy was able to play despite being 7'4", 300 most of the game and did a really good job. Mitchell, I do still have questions about what Braxton said about his lateral quickness. You know, Braxton mentioned Walker Kessler's, you know, there's question marks about him. How many minutes has he been able to play just because he's a very big guy that, you know, struggles to switch onto perimeter offensive scores, such as like with what we saw with Rudy Gobert in the playoffs. There was, I mean, he's widely regarded as an elite defender, but when you get him switched onto Luka Doncic, it's just not a good defensive strategy. You got to sit him in drop coverage that opens up the door for point guards to really have success. So what gives you confidence that Zach Edey can either overcome those things, or maybe he won't be able to, but he'll still be able to play enough to be a good fantasy player?
Yeah, I mean, we really hone in on that per minute production when we look at Zach Edey as an asset. And as we're kind of shifting towards a new era, I know small ball was a big thing, you know, in the 2010s, but now like we need to, teams are looking to draft Wembanyama stoppers, Jokic stoppers, and Embiid stoppers. We're kind of focusing more in on those big men, and we need someone who can kind of deflect them, put some pressure on them, especially in spot minutes. You know, I know for sure, even though I am higher on Edie than most, that he's not going to be playing over 25 minutes a night. But even in 20 minutes, Edie can provide that top 100 production. And I just want to give some a little bit perspective too. 20 years ago in the early 2000s or even in the 1990s, Edie would be in contention for the number one pick in most drafts, given his touch, his size, his motor, something that, you know, me and Andrew talk about a lot. Zach Edey was playing over 35 minutes a night
in these March Madness games where he was a very pivotal point in the Purdue Boilermakers offense. So he can play long minutes if he can, but it's just the fact that teams nowadays in the NBA are so pick and roll heavy and spaced out that he can't play those minutes, even though he can. He's going to be more seen as like a counter to some of those bigger guys like Nikola Jokic. So I do want to add, I know we like talk about Ivica Zubac as someone's like who he's kind of like lumbering, but he's one of the better defenders when he's guarding Nikola Jokic. And a lot of people don't really talk about that. He gives Jokic a lot of trouble, but mm-hmm. when he is switched on, let's say like a Steph Curry, then yeah, of course he looks bad. But Zach Edey in the right spot, he's like a six inches taller than Zubac, and you're going to have a lot of reaping benefits out of that from a dynasty perspective.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the defense is something where it's a situational thing. There's definitely use for a 7'4", 300 guy, even in the modern NBA, especially with the centers you mentioned, like Jokic, like Wemby. Chet's a skinnier guy like Wemby as well, but big guys that can kind of counter the size of these other teams with elite centers. Andrew, can you talk to me a little bit about the offensive games? I know he did a lot of posting up at Purdue and got to the free throw line a ton. And I just don't see an NBA team, regardless of where he's drafted, saying, hey, we're going to stick Zach Edey on the block and you guys are going to feed him the ball, and that's how we're going to play offense this season. It's going to be more, okay, what else can he do? Can he be an offensive hub at the top of the key and pass? Can he run the pick and roll and finish? Are those things that you're confident he'll be able to do at the next level?
Yeah, that's, you know, I guess that's the bad news to all the Edey fans out there, is there's definitely no teams that's going to change the nature of their offense or their system for Zach Edey to be in the starting unit and be a feature star. I just don't know if I see that happening. I don't know if he's that gravitational of a player to make the franchise change for him like a Victor Wembanyama was. But I can see that happen to a team's second unit, because there's basically two potential positive outcomes with Edey. Either number one, he learns to mesh in with all the starters and become a regular starting center, like the examples, Ivica Zubac, or he's going to become maybe like a focal point for a team when one or two stars are off the floor. Like maybe if they have one star big man, he's off the floor and they put in Edey, or maybe their stars are more guard heavy and then one or two are off the floor and they put Edey in to eat in the post. What I think is the more likely outcome, is because like it's going to take a lot for, like, Mitch is definitely right. The big man is back. It for sure is. And there's going to be teams trying to draft solutions to Wembanyama, especially as this guy gets older. He's going to be an absolute monster to deal with. And there's just not really guys in the NBA that are equipped to handle him. So you're going to see teams start to favor more giants again, like they did in the past. Like the real last time that this happened, where one player started to change the body type of the league, was Shaquille O'Neal. No one knew how to deal with a physical freak like that. So they had to start drafting guys in an attempt to deal with him. And I think that's going to start happening with Wemby. Edey can potentially be one of those guys that helps with that. But also, too, someone like him, who was such a heavy usage player on his team and was, you know, did have great touch, great scoring prowess, I do see him feasting against second units if a team like does make their game plan with him involved in that way. I just don't know if I see him. I don't know how on board I am with the idea of him meshing into like a starting unit and running along the rest of the stars like a Zubac, as we were using as an example.
Yeah, and Braxton, back to you. I know you mentioned that you don't really see him falling far outside the lottery. You mentioned a few teams like in the late lottery, or I think just outside that as well. But in the scenario where he slides down the board, maybe just looking through a few teams that are kind of in the later first round, New Orleans could be losing Jonas Valanciunas. He could fill in there. Phoenix could use depth with basically everything. The Bucks, there's been talks of them moving off Brook Lopez, things like that. If he ends up being drafted later in the first, are you still confident that, hey, this is a guy that it doesn't really kind of matter where he lands, or if it's later in the first, early second, I still think he can make an impact? Or are you kind of banking on, oh, this guy is going to go in the lottery, he's a lottery talent, like there's a reason that they're taking him up there, they have an important, like, laid out plan for him? Or are you just kind of like, which is totally fine if you are, just banking on his talent?
Yeah, to me, this number 15 ranking we have is kind of factoring in that he doesn't go in the lottery, because I think if the team follows through on that top 10 reported top 10 promise that's out there, I think it's undeniable you do have to push him several spots higher. Now, if he falls to somebody like Phoenix, like you said, who just lost Drew Eubanks and can use somebody besides Yusuf Nurkic to play, I think, and I know I just said some negative things about Walker Kessler, but, you know, remember when Walker Kessler got drafted, I think it was 18th or 19th to Utah, and we saw him, you know, contribute immediately and was a legitimate fantasy asset immediately. So it's, and I think Edie is a better prospect than Kessler. He may be better than Kessler is right now. So even if he falls into the 20s, I think whatever team is grabbing him there, especially if it's a team that lacks depth and has a spot for him, it's not really any kind of concern to me at all. You know, some of these teams that have all these expensive old guys on their teams, like, Milwaukee or Phoenix, where, you know, they're not going to be able to bring in big free agents. They have to rely on these late teens, early 20s picks to kind of fill out the roster. So I do think the talent will exceed wherever he gets drafted, I guess, to answer your question.
Yeah. And as once you were talking about some of these teams, I had to look back, found the tweets. There are reports, I think it was from Kevin O'Connor of The Ringer, that Portland could target him as early as 7, but they also pick again at 14. So we'll see. I think all of these rumors at this point, like, who knows what's actually going to happen. A lot of it is just smoke. So we'll see. I think that would be pretty interesting if he did end up going 7. I think we do have to kind of adjust the ranks a little bit. He would be splitting minutes with Ayton, but they're taking him at 7 for a reason. They obviously right. like him a lot. So, all right. Those are the three guys that we had to talk about. If anybody that is watching does have questions, they can drop them in the chat. But until then, we'll just kind of talk about guys that were either lower on or higher on the consensus. I do have your big board pulled up, and it seems like we're all on the same page as far as Zachary Risacher goes. So Mitchell, I'll start with you. A lot of people are mocking him to my Atlanta Hawks at 1. I'm wearing my shirt in the hopes that that's not going to happen, but we will see. Can you just talk to me about why you're lower on Risacher than potentially other people are?
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the stat set, there's nothing really eye-popping. Like, is he a shooter? We don't know. He had a hot stretch that really inflated his efficiency numbers. He does get some steals, but nothing really in the rebounds department, nothing, pretty much a net negative in assist turnover ratio as well. So if you're taking Risacher in the top 5 for your fantasy drafts, you're pretty much drafting like a DeAndre Hunter, like another Hawks player who's not very flashy. He does get the job done. He does have a solid floor. And I'm fine taking Risacher at the back end of the lottery, knowing I have someone who does kind of have cost control in salary leagues. Well, kind of not really at the same time. If he's taking number 1, he's going to be making $13 million a year from the get-go. But at the same time, there's just nothing very exciting about Risacher. There's a lot of weird inconsistencies about his season. And like, as a Hawks fan, I'm kind of pivoting it back to you. Do you buy that hot streak in Zachary Risacher? And do you even see him as a potential number 3 option behind Trae Young and Jalen Johnson, assuming one of the guards gets moved?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. Is that it is, what do the Hawks believe? Like, I don't think that, but clearly he showed enough in his workout that they at least kind of think that, hey, maybe this thing will pan out and he will be a really good shooter and a good defender. I think that it's kind of mixed results based on who you talk to as far as what he's going to be defensively. And then I don't think he's shown any sort of shot creation, but maybe they're saying, hey, that's something that we can work on. I don't know. It is kind of, I guess, drafting the idea of what Risacher could be as opposed to what he's shown. Andrew, I'm going to ask you to take a little bit more of a positive angle and, like, if Risacher pans out, or is that something if you just can't do a positive angle?
I'll totally do my best. So, because for a moment here, I thought this was maybe the first annual meeting of the Zachary Risacher Haters Club, but we'll spin some positivity to this. I mean, I know. So I guess one thing that's been kind of bothering me is like there's teams that are saying, oh, there's, you know, you can't really pass up on a guy with this type of size and movement ability. But then he goes to the combine and has small hands, small wingspan, and a low vertical. So there's not that. But and then there's the streaky shooting too. But we have to, I guess, for starters, Vegas is always right. You have to take a good amount of credit into what Vegas is saying with him being such high odds to for sure go in the top three. So there's that aspect. And so you have to, you know, kind of just have at least some belief in what some of these NBA franchises are thinking. Like, for example, he's in the lottery of our big board because someone's likely going to spend, you know, a top pick on him. We really don't like him. And if he somehow managed to fall to a team that's lower down the board, then we'll probably move him down our board after that too. But that's the only reason why we left him up there is because he's likely going to get drafted in the top three. So I know that he does represent probably like one of, I guess, theoretically one of the higher ceilings that is in this draft class. It's the floor that scares me the most. Like ever since in one of our previous podcasts, I called him Torian Prince, and it's really hard for me to shake that from my head ever since I did that. But I do see the ceiling that they're talking about. I think why we have him lower on the board is that we just have some serious doubts about that ceiling. But I do see why there is interest in him.
If the Hawks don't draft him, we will definitely start the Reese Shea hate club. But if the Hawks draft him, like all of a sudden you got Reese Shea's number one fan right here. But Mitchell mentioned DeAndre Hunter. You mentioned Torian Prince. Braxton, are we going with another Atlanta Hawks forward that didn't end up being anything close to what they were supposed to be? Are we going with Marvin Williams as the comp? Like how are you feeling as Zachary Reese Shea?
Well, Marvin Williams is a Atlanta Hawks forward, isn't he?
But, exactly.
In terms of fantasy outlook, you know, I'm a big believer in draft capital in terms of just, you know, overall safety when it comes to your personal rookie draft. And if he goes number one, I think just like I think it'd be impossible. I don't know if Andrew and Mitch agree with me, but I think it's really hard to have him down at 11 on our big board if he goes number one. I think you got to just, you know, vault him up to at least 5, 6, or 7. Just based on draft capital alone. Somebody that kind of reminds me of, and this is kind of the opposite situation, I guess, because we saw Cam Whitmore fall down draft boards last year, and he ended up being, you know, pretty decent in fantasy leagues. That's kind of who I'm thinking of, maybe not in terms of a player comp, but in terms of a fantasy asset, where, you know, he's not really going to be an all-around guy, but he's like a one or two category type guy. Who still, you know, has a place on in some builds. And, you know, if he has the potential to become that number two option, like a lot of teams think he do, maybe he'll exceed Cam Whitmore's fantasy value. But to me, that's kind of, fantasy, that's who I'm comparing him to.
Yeah, I'll try and do a little bit of a positive spin. And say
it's hard.
It's entirely just talking about the idea of what he could be as a big wing that can really shoot the ball and is like reportedly, like scouts are saying, a good defender. I think it depends on who you ask, but if he is going to be a tall guy that can shoot and play defense, like, and not, you know, creating his own shot, but maybe put the ball on the floor, you know, pump fake, one dribble, go dunk the ball. Like, is he potentially an MPJ with defense? I mean, that would be elite, but I'm not buying that at all. Hopefully if the Hawks draft him, that's what he ends up being. But we'll see what happens. Another guy that I'm looking at y'all's board, you guys are pretty high on, is Tyler Kolek. A guy when I was scouting, I really liked. But you guys have him up at 19, and I've pretty much everything I've seen is that he's either a late first round guy, potentially even an early second round guy. I see Mitchell and Andrew, you guys are already smiling. Andrew, can you talk to me a little bit about why you guys like Tyler Kolek?
So I'm going to have to pass it off to Mitchell, actually. This is okay. His boy. I do like Kolek, but this is our Kolek expert on staff.
Perfect.
Yeah, Tyler Kolek is just – he's my pretty much Jaime Jaquez, like, senior-type guy in this draft, you know. You see him if he's, you know, potentially going to the Phoenix Suns, who are in dire need of a point guard. He has that high efficiency numbers, high assist number rate, and then also he's a positive in steals too. I mean, he is a little bit undersized, but he is such a cerebral player. He's a connective piece. He plays within the offense and he can rack up stats really quick. Tyler Kolek is, we have him at 19. I wanted this, you know, to put him in.
This was a debate. This was a lengthy debate.
Andrew was at my house. I was like, man, like, I really want to put him in the mid-teens if possible, maybe even in the late lottery, just because I can definitely see in the right landing spot, like the Miami Heat is another team that can use a point guard. You know, he's going to have that potential upside, like maybe a Brandon Pajemski with better efficiency numbers. You know, and everyone's mocking Pajemski in startups in like the top 75. So, I mean, we'll have to wait and see, depending on fit. I think he could really, really be a great beneficiary on the Phoenix Suns and the Miami Heat. Maybe even some team like the Milwaukee Bucks, if he falls down that far, playing alongside Damian Lillard and learning the ropes eventually as he phases out on an aging team. But yeah, Tyler Kolek is great. I want to know why you like him too and why we're on the same wavelength.
I think it was, you know, watching a little bit of film, reading about him, looking at the stats, like just him being a very solid player. I mean, you mentioned the Suns as a, like, that was what went through my mind was, oh, they really do need a point guard. And he is a guy that has a lot of, like, plays with a lot of effort, a lot of heart, and is a good playmaker, like a TJ McConnell kind of. I think that's a pretty common comp that you'll see for him. I'm like, oh, I think that is something the Suns could use, considering they've been playing without a point guard, without a true point guard, all last season, and it just didn't go very well. So, Braxton, we know Mitchell loves Tyler Kolek. Are you on the same page? Or are you lower or kind of eh?
Yeah, I've said this a couple times, but I just love the older prospects who are mocked to contending teams. I think there's such a pathway early on for immediate fantasy value. And I think Tyler Kolek falls directly into that. I feel like I've pretty much attributed everybody to Phoenix at this point, but maybe that's more of a testament to just kind of what they're missing. But, you know, Milwaukee, another one in a perfect spot for him at 23, who could use a backup point guard. If, I don't know if Patrick Beverly is going to be coming back or not, but it just there's such an opportunity there for these older prospects to make a name for themselves. That's the best landing spot to me. I know that's not really about Kolek specifically, but more so just like a overarching theme about some of these older prospects you'll find towards the 20s.
Whoever the Suns draft, that's who we need to be taking in Dynasty rookie drafts. It's a good point because they'll probably need whoever they draft just for their lack of depth. Andrew, how much lower on Tyler Kolek like were you than Mitchell? Because I know you said it was a bit of a debate to keep him out of the lottery. He's still in the top 20. So we'll
this
see.
Wasn't like a huge spread apart, like, oh, I think he should be 35 and Mitch wanted him to lottery. It wasn't that big apart. I was probably thinking more like early 20s. Like A.J. Mitchell, who I covered, I was in agreement that Kolek can be over him. I had no issue with that. That one example there. So I was thinking like 21, 22, 23, something around there. Mitch, like you said, was thinking either later lottery there was like a couple of key players ahead of him that I just had a really hard time putting him over. And so that was where we ended up settling with him at 19. So it wasn't like a massive discrepancy. But it just was one, especially at that point in our first round where I had a bit of a hard time. So like looking at the board here. Yeah. So like Jared McCain and Tijon Solon are in front of him. Those are two guys I had a very hard time putting Kolek ahead of. Dayron Holmes would be above them two at 16. All three of those guys, especially Holmes, I like a lot. I was not okay with putting Kolek above them. Like, you know, through the debate, I was okay putting him above names like Tyler Smith, Kelo Ware, which is eventually why he ended up at a spot like 19. But yeah, I think he kind of just ran into a roadblock ahead of him of some of these names like McCain, Solon, Holmes, Edie, that I couldn't push him any further.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. I think that, again, like I said right at the beginning, depending on whose boards you look at, you could have a guy like Tyler Kolek in the lottery, or you could have him down in the 50s, and that's what makes this draft so much fun. Guys, that's all we have for this episode. I appreciate you guys a ton for hopping on. What can we be on the lookout for from Engle Fantasy Basketball with the draft coming up and with free agency after that? What kind of content should we be looking out for?
So content-wise, we will do an update to our big board immediately following the draft. We'll probably give a day or two to watch some of the undrafted free agents go in. Those are important, too. You want to try to find your Austin Reeves out there. So once we see that, we will update the big board. We will have the big board expand to over 70, which is going to be available on our Patreon, which we plan to start soon too, which is going to provide additional content to what we're offering now. So we're going to stay the same with everything we've been offering, videos, rankings, podcasts, that's all going to stay there. But we're going to work to bring additional stuff that's going to be available through Patreon. So we'll be talking all about all of that pretty soon here. But other than that, you can we'll be, of course, talking about the draft heavily. We'll be posting a lot on Twitter. You can follow us there at AngleFantasyBB. And then you can find our YouTube page at Angle Fantasy Basketball.
Yeah. So everyone listening, make sure to hit them with a follow, hit them with the subscribe on YouTube. Check out all their content. It is great work. Gentlemen, thank you guys so much for joining me. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Take Me Later podcast. And I will see you guys next time.
Thank you for having me.
You just listened to another episode from the Fantasy Basketball International Podcast Network. Thanks for joining us. And for more information about joining our community, please check out our website at fbibasketball.com.